Dina is the CEO of Super 78, and they are the 4D dark rides you know and love so much, the immersive entertainment experiences that show up at theme parks. That's what Dina does. Then at Lance Weiler, no one has a name anymore. You're just your Twitter hit. At Lance Weiler, Lance is one of the foremost pioneers in exploring not just collaborative storytelling and multi-platform storytelling, but digital literacy. And then we have at John M. Chu, whose latest project, G.I. Joe 2, is coming out. John is also the International Digital Emmy Award Pioneer Prize winner last year for LXD, which is quite a pioneering work unto itself. So, and I am at Brian Seth Hurst, all one word. So welcome, and let's get started. So Tracy, we each have stories to tell. I wanted to give you four different perspectives. So now we're going to talk about the immersive experience and learnings of games as stories.
Great. Awesome. So I'm going to talk really quickly because I have so much to show you. I'm so excited about it. So I work at the School of Cinematic Arts. It's a super old school. In fact, it's the oldest school of cinema in the nation. I mean, this place is so old. This is, you know, the kind of things that they used to have there. And just recently, we got a massive rebuild of our facility. But the school is, you know, so old that we made it look like an old studio. And I am one of the kind of radical new faculty there. I teach game design as part of the interactive media division. And so part of what my job is when students come in and they think this is what they're going to do, is to show them that this is what they're going to do, right? They're going to just have this wild expanse of different media types available to them. And a couple of years ago, the dean of the school was actually a really forward-thinking woman, Elizabeth Daly, put together a committee, which I'm not going to tell you about at all because committees are super boring, but she gave us a bunch of goals about teaching students to live in this new DIY media world and really rebooting the whole culture of what it is the school does. So to do that, we made this awesome game. We made this experience that was completely unrecognized by the school. It was completely underground, and it was for the freshmen who came in this year, and they were told nothing about it in orientation. Some of them got cards in their bag that pointed them to a website with a countdown. Some of them saw a flag hanging from the balcony in the courtyard. Some of them started talking about it on Facebook, and some of them actually got emails from mysterious Dr. Huizinga, who gave them protocol on what to do when they saw the flag. So there was a lot of different mysterious clues, and eventually the students who picked up on these clues wound up finding their way to this game office filled with graduate students who would give them these cards. And so these cards had little pieces of media history that we hoped that they would discover along their path as they were learning all these wonderful things from all the amazing people in the school. But that isn't actually what the coolest part of the game was. On the other side of these cards were prompts. So one kind of prompt, this is a green card, prompted you to make a silent short and gives you a certain amount of points. Other kinds of cards actually modified that. So if you made a silent short in the SCA courtyard, you got more points, and so forth and so on. So if you actually made a silent short about greed in the SCA courtyard, you got even more points. And if you included Cody Wilder, who might be a student that you never heard of before, but you searched out and found among your compatriots of the freshman class, you get even more points. There were blue rare cards that, for example, challenged you to work across all the divisions of the film school. And what do you know? The kids started playing with the cards right away, and they started getting down and meeting each other, and they started making deals, bigger and bigger deals, and it became actual madness. Before the second week of the term started, we had probably about 50 students participating out of a class of 140, and they were creating things like games and films and trailers and music videos and character artifacts and radio plays, and they were banding into teams of what I would call a productive chaos. A sort of tribalism took over the school. Before the end of this, we had 120 pieces of media. We had over 200 students registered. And these students really started digging in deep and making these huge projects. One of the key things about the design of this game is that everyone who participated on a project got points for it. So if you created a big team and you had a lot of cards, you got a lot of points, and everybody got points. And then they started being really competitive about it. So like, if I can find their Sorry. Okay. Let me show you.
They said it was just a... We were supposed to collaborate, become friends. Boy, were they wrong.
Why do they call you the master of the game?
It's, kind of a long story.
Good luck.
What's a member of Laura doing here anyways?
I'm looking for someone named Amber. I thought I could find her here. Do you know?
You're looking at her.
At first, she was just another orange card. Someone else to use. But then, something changed.
There are only two winners this week.
Tribe, I was at your party?
I never said anything. Why are you blaming me?
Because you're the only one who knows I was there.
A deal's a deal.
I made a few enemies. You don't understand. It was the only way to win.
But at what cost, Carver? What have you done?
You keep this up, I'm taking this to Sam.
Okay, so that was all student-produced DIY media on top of their regular assignments and included about 20 students from across all the divisions of the film school. And like I say, there was about 120 media projects that were produced. What happened was every week, the weekly leaders were sent another mysterious email told to meet a car on a street corner or show up at a secret location. And they were rewarded for their participation in this game with mentorship experiences, whether that was meeting up with a game designer like Frank Lance, or going to the home of Dante Spinotti. You can see actually in the upright corner, they're kneeling in front of Dante's poster of 8 1/2. They had to do that before he would let them into his home to discuss cinematography and art and life. And then down at the bottom, they're meeting with John Singleton. We had so many great alumni participate in this, and it's really already started to rewrite the story of the school, and I think rewrite the story of what these students expect to do as media makers when they go out into the industry. So that's really what I have to say, except for I can't talk about this project without giving kudos to the lead designers on the project, specifically Jeff Watson, who's an amazing star, and should look out for his name. And you can find out more and see a lot of other projects at reality.usc.edu.
So what's great about this is you had told me when we originally spoke that you wanted to get the students into storytelling right away, that the way for them to learn storytelling was to immerse them in it.
Yes.
So the cards became the stimulus.
They're like a procedural prompt, right? So, you know, the best thing about learning to be a creative person is when you pick up the core idea that constraints are the heart of making good stories, right? So the cards are a way of helping them create a sort of prompting, making a box around what it is that they should do together. So these are kids who show up at school, they've you know, come from all parts of the country, none of them know each other, and within a week they're already putting together these brainstorms around these procedural
prompting. It is so much of what the entertainment industry does, because you go to produce a movie and or a television show, and you throw a whole bunch of people, some of whom might have been together before, but together in an environment where they have to learn who they are, have to get on board with the story that's being told, have to bring their ideas to the table. And so, you know, we always talk about, well, how do you teach multi-platform storytelling? How do you teach game design? How do you teach these things? And what I found really interesting about this is it's teaching by it's like learning a new language. It's like being thrown into France, and in order to eat, you must speak French or at least learn to point.
Well, and the other thing, too, is it doesn't privilege any particular media, right? So the green cards span all forms of media that we could really think of, and it was up to the students to play the cards – that they had and to collaborate and to bond with other students who had different green cards. And so that would actually push them into places they weren't necessarily comfortable. We had writing students learning to program to make video games, and we had production students working on animation flip books, and basically it was like pushing them into places they weren't necessarily thinking they were headed.
So part of this, and we've allotted so much time for each presentation, so it'd be great just to like go one-on-one with each of these people, as you'll see. But part of the opportunity here is we are learning so much about multi-platform storytelling and how it evolves. And this sounds like this was an organic evolution. Most people come to the table with, here's my plan. But this sounds like this was really based on having a need to tell a story, being compelled to use media to tell the story and select the right media regardless of the circumstance. To tell the story.
Yeah, and I also want to say that one of the reasons I think this turned out so well, this particular project, is because it was completely underground and under the radar, and, we didn't really have anyone telling us what to do. So Jeff Watson and myself and Simon Wiscombe, who were the sort of the core design team, we just got to make the best game that we could think of.
It's interesting, because you see it as a game, and I see it as an entry into storytelling. And it's because that convergence of game and story, that's part of the war story that's being told, is you have people that have great skills in games, and you have people who have great skills in storytelling, and so you see more stories, including game elements. I mean, if you watch Touch, which is coming up on Fox, that whole hour of that pilot was one giant video game to me. You might not believe that. So, and the other side is I see games, the storytellers. So we're going to move on. Thank you so much, Tracy. To Dina Benadon. And boy, oh boy, Dina and I have talked for a long time, and I happen to believe that if you experience 4D dark rides and you love them, within 3 to 5 years, the technologies that enable that to happen at a theme park will be available in your home, especially with sense scanning technology and all of that. Are you good to go?
Almost. There you go. It's a little hard to navigate when the thing is down there, but bear with us.
So, anyone playing Uncharted 3? Okay, I'm looking for story and games. BioShock people. Oh, come on, people. I mean, groundbreaking and an addiction of mine. How about Arkham City?
Where? Right there, isn't that it?
Okay. Let's see, Arkham City Enterprise. Sorry, there's one I'm missing. Oh, L.A. Noire. So, if you're a storyteller, you need to pay attention. This is my opinion, of course. You need to pay attention to what's going on in games. Really important. And that's why I always call Tracy like once a quarter just to find out what's going on. But to see the evolution of gaming and even in terms of production, I mean, just amazing. So Uncharted 3 is cinematic. It's got a lot of story elements. BioShock is based on objectivism. Okay, we're having a problem. So while you're figuring that out, I'm going to go to John. So we'll just watch this because John doesn't have a presentation. So, John.
Here, I got it.
John, you got
wait.
It?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Saved. All right, fine. Fine, take it. Just to add on to the USC thing, I was being a freshman once at USC Film School, and what I remember the first 2 years, you can't really participate in the film school because you're all doing all your GEs. And so we were sort of there, all these creative people. You're so excited to go to USC Film School, and you literally have nothing creative to do but you're with all these film people. You meet them on the first day of school, and then you never see them for 2 years. So I think that the fact that you have this platform to have them collaborate and at least have a starting place to create things is to me, I would have loved that as a freshman.
Tracy, will you approve John's application to go back to school?
Oh yeah, we'd love to have you,
Dina.
Yes. Hi. Oh, hi there. It's my first time at South by Southwest, first time in Austin, too, and I'm really excited to be here, so thanks for having me, Brian. I'm here to talk about experiential storytelling and the kind of stories that, or the kind of experiential storytelling that I'm talking about is the kind that you find at Disneyland or Universal Studios, like the classic attractions like Pirates of the Caribbean or the Haunted Mansion. And it's kind of where you're completely immersed in another world. So recently, in the last 10 to 15 years or so, the industry has expanded into these other markets that include museums and science centers and zoos, aquariums, and even visitor centers. So I'm going to focus on one specific media-based attraction that my company produced in this modern-day museum and highlight some of the atypical challenges that we encountered along the way. But first, I wanted to say a few things about the themed entertainment industry, since that really is the incubator for new technologies and attractions. Walt Disney is really the pioneer of multi-platform storytelling. He had his characters, shorts, movies, books. He had a TV show that promoted the movies and the characters. And for him, the ultimate platform was the theme park. It's a physical place where people could go and interact with the stories and the characters and experience them in a whole new way. And if Walt had the internet, he would have definitely used it. I think that a Walt Disney 2 would be considered the pioneer of media distribution. So theme parks themselves are known for pushing the envelope with state-of-the-art attractions. And today we're the ones spending the hundreds of millions of dollars to promote these attractions and to create these concepts that incorporate the newest technologies and new ways of entertaining guests. So Universal Studios and Disney's are the clear leaders in this space, and in the last 5 years or so, there's been an explosion of new attractions. It's a 2.0 for our industry, and there's a slew of new rides coming out. There's Transformers, King Kong 3D, Despicable Me, and the ultimate in multi-platform storytelling is Harry Potter. All of these attractions involve technology, and they all immerse the guest in a unique way. Museums, science centers, zoos, aquariums, visitor centers, they all take their cue from the theme park industry, and they apply those attraction sensibilities to the more historical and nonfiction-based sites. And like theme parks, museums are physical spaces. So those same theme park designers and storytellers are the same creatives being tapped to produce these more fact-based experiences. What we do is one part movie making, one part urban planning, one part architecture, and one part technology. And all of these things are tied together in a story that is the foundation and the thread that weaves them all together. My company, Super 78, designs and creates attractions for theme parks and also for these non-fiction-based sites around the world. We work with existing brands and with original ideas to produce these immersive experiences. And by taking the design approach to theme parks and applying it to the museum installation, what we're doing is creating a really powerful, fun, and factual experience. So how do we do it? I'm going to take you through this one case study, which is a fact-based attraction that we produced at the Maritime Museum in Singapore. The museum opened in October of last year, and it's based on the island of Sentosa in Singapore. It's a really small part of the Resorts World Sentosa Integrated Resort, which is an $8 billion development built by Genting. And it includes 8 hotels and casinos, a Universal Studios theme park, high-end restaurants and retail. And this is the shot of the building designed by the architect Michael Graves and the acclaimed museum designer Ralph Applebaum and associates were brought in to oversee the exhibit design and the implementation. So the story itself really starts with the architecture. It's a maritime museum, and this is a building shaped as a upside-down hull of a ship. Super 78 was hired as the creative team to design the guest experience and to produce the media for the experience for the centerpiece attraction that's called Typhoon 360. So we designed, wrote, and choreographed the film and the attraction, starting the story from the minute the guest actually enter the building. So in a theme park attraction, we typically have 2 to 3 years for development and for production. of a pre-show and a main show. And then in the museum world, budgets and schedules are really tight. And for this project in particular, the inexperienced client that we were working with wanted a lot more that they could afford. So,
as it happens.
Yeah. So our scope of work was to produce, was to design a 3-minute pre-show and a 6-minute main show. We had to produce the main show film at 8K, 8,000 lines of resolution, and for a 360-degree screen. We had to incorporate sensory elements like wind, smell, water spray, and seat motion, and involve the surround sound. We had to incorporate a moving platform that physically drops the 150 guests 30 feet all at the same time at the end of the show and create the perception that the audience is sinking or drowning in a typhoon. Wow. And while the audience lowers, the height of the screen is actually going to expand at the same time. Though the budget of this experience was less than what a typical half-hour network television show would cost, and the schedule was only 6 months from concept to install.
Talk about drowning.
Yeah, that's what we felt like. The attraction has to live in this space for 10 years, so it's got to be really, really good. So they wanted a good, cheap, fast, all three. On top of that, the clients were 8,000 miles away, and there's a 14-hour time difference from Singapore to L.A. And here's the clincher. They hired a local construction company to oversee and manage the project, and they had no experience doing this at all. So that was one end of the spectrum. And then the other end of the spectrum was that we had this world-class museum designer who was focused on authenticity and accuracy. So we had a lot of different agendas to juggle. The attraction itself was built around the Jewel of Muscat, which is a ship that sank during the Tang Dynasty in the 9th century. The shipwreck was discovered in 1998, along with the cargo that included 60,000 artifacts, with the treasure of the collection being this unique golden chalice that from the Emperor's court. So our script needed to be factual and authentic and still possess a compelling story structure that included the spectacle of a theme park attraction and that could immerse the audience into feeling as if they were there with these characters on the ship. So we started the typical pre-production process of storyboards, previs, key art, research, casting, and we were moving really fast. And during that initial kickoff process, we learned that the client really wanted to focus the entire experience on this golden chalice. So at the same time that we're building the replica of the chalice, which the client demands we redo multiple times because they wanted it even bigger than the actual size, which was smaller than a teacup, our researchers, consultants, historians, and museum experts that we worked with couldn't find anything on the story that surrounded this chalice and how it came to be. So our writers created a fictionalized story incorporating a merchant family. On behalf of the Emperor of China, the family embarks upon a suicide mission into a deadly storm to deliver the golden chalice to the Sultanate of Oman. The important thing here is that we give the guest an immersive experience so that they know what it's like to be in that world and be on that vessel. We transport them into the story. More effective than giving people facts is to take them there, and we're able to do that so much more powerfully because we're reaching people on multiple sensory levels. So we went into production, live production on a stage in Los Angeles. We did our visual effects in Korea and Canada and produced high-end film for an extremely tight budget. At 6 months, the movie is done. Looks amazing. The attraction's installed. The show's ready to open, which means that they're allowed to open the casino now, which was the real motivation for the tight schedule. And now 6 months is actually 1 month later than the original delivery date that the client promised the government of Singapore, which means that there's a penalty for being late, because it's Singapore. Now, one of the reasons why the schedule was pushed from 5 months to 6 months is because of all the back and forth over the chalice size between the museum experts fighting for authenticity and for accuracy and keeping it small. And the owner wanted something much bigger. They wanted something more like a beer stein that you would find at Oktoberfest and something that holds a lot of casino chips.
Size does matter.
So, ready for the penalty? All the treasures, including the golden chalice, which was the thread for the entire experience that we built the story on, was given to the competitor casino across the way. So, the Marina Bay Sands. So now the Maritime Museum would only get to house the ship itself. So at the end of the day, despite the loss of our chalice, which to us was our Mickey Mouse, the experience turned out great. The attraction's a huge success for the museum. The Visual Effects Society nominated the film for best in that category of visual effects, and the guests love it, which is the most important thing. And but more importantly, the concepts and the ideas about maritime travel and the people of the time come across and deliver a visceral experience so that when the guests walk away, they really understand what it was like to be a crew member of a trading vessel in the 9th century. So, and here's just a small one-minute clip of what we did. Oops, sorry.
And thanks to you, hundreds of people drown every day. While you're pulling that up, I think like the future of storytelling now seems to be hung on degree of immersion. Get it? Immersion here, and reality ends here. Deeper immersion here.
How do I play it?
It's
Uh-oh.
Playing.
Oh, there it goes. Okay.
Hope our luck continues to hold.
You've been to Oman before?
We have, through our usual routes.
What I didn't mention was that the audience, so you come into the show and you walk into the theater and you're coming through the museum, and then at the end of the show when the audience lowers down, the doors open and you exit into the aquarium itself. And you're feeling the cold, they turn up the air conditioning and it's really cold, and you get this whole experience and walking through, you're in the aquarium at the end.
Oh, that was wonderful. I hope your minds are just going and filled with imagination, because technology is enabling us to tell stories in ways that we never imagined possible, and is allowing for the participation of the audience and the collaboration of the audience in ways that haven't been possible before. So I'm probably older than most of the people in the audience, but if you remember MacGyver, okay, Lance Wyler is the MacGyver of multi-platform storytelling. Because when Lance wants to tell a story, there is nothing that stops him. Not technology, not the lack of funds, nothing. He just goes and he does it. Ladies and gentlemen, Lance Wyler.
Thank you. I've never been introduced before as MacGyver. That's very cool. Well, thank you very much for having me here today, Brian. What I am going to talk about is really a lot of what I'm empowered by is kind of quickly failing and learning from that failure and moving on. And I think looking at rapidly prototyping the types of stories that I want to make and kind of going through and and just finding interesting ways to. Sorry, let me go here. Is it?
I really wanted to give you a span of what's going on in storytelling. How are we doing so far? I always find it amazing that something like what Dina built is incredible, and then we get in front of a laptop and we can't get our presentations to work.
Well, it would be easier if we could see it. But
okay. So what I want to effectively talk about, I'm going to try to throw three things in here really quickly. But a lot of what I'm doing is rapidly prototyping. This first project that I'm going to talk about was called Pandemic. It ties into a larger story world that I'm working on. There's part of it is a feature film that I'm doing with Ted Hope and Ann Carey, which is set 90 days into this outbreak of this strange sleep virus that only affects adults, kind of leaves the youth to their own devices, and 120 hours to kind of play within this other world was a simulation that I did that took place at Sundance, where I was doing Pandemic 1.0, and I called it 1.0 is because I treat story almost as software, and I released it as a way to kind of look at what the initial outbreak was like. So it was a way to kind of test the world and try a number of different things with it. So in terms of the 120 hours, what I did was I established a kind of an urban game, mobile, online, a variety of different things that consisted of this story world. And we took it to Sundance, where we had about 40,000 people who come and attend. And I was very interested in how I could design something that was effectively hyper-local and then global at the same time. When I look at this, and you'll see when I get to the tail end of the presentation, I feel like, if I'm honest with myself, I could have effectively done this with maybe about two-thirds of what I was actually playing with. But the idea was to be able to experiment. And at the center of this was a short film, told a story about a boy and a girl who are coming to terms with the fact that their mother is transforming, and they're not sure what to do. Do they leave her? Do they kill her? And it was kind of an emotional story. And within that, that day and date had played out through the festival. We got it on FearNet, so it was in homes, and then it was also on the app for Sundance, which was pretty cool. You could kind of go through and you could see when you turned on the app, you would see Facebook and Twitter, YouTube, and a little icon for Pandemic, so that was pretty neat. But it consisted of a variety of things, this whole world that we kind of built. And really, the driver of it was there were 50 golden objects that were hidden all throughout Park City, and 50 bottles of water. And what we did was we constructed kind of a CDC mission control space. What's interesting about this is I'm really driven by this idea of big data and how data can be used within storytelling. So if you walked into this room over the 5 days that we were doing it, every moment the room was changing. It went through a five-act structure. So real-world interactions were fueling things that were actually happening within this space. And we wrote a contextual storytelling engine that would measure things that were like check-ins, that would look at if somebody tweeted pandemic, hashtag 11, it would save a life. If somebody came back and brought one of the golden objects or found one of the bottles of water, it actually had a health property to it. And so this room was constantly changing, and it had a surface table in the center where you could go and you could kind of manipulate the room. At the same time, we released 50 Nexus S NFC compliant phones out into the wild.
NFC, near field communication.
Thank you. People familiar with that? It's like a QR code reader, except your phone is aware. You don't have to turn on the camera. You don't have to turn on the app. It kind of just will wake up when you're near something. And so we released them in biohazard bags. 50 of them went out. 17 of them never came back. But they had hand cranks. And so people just passed them and passed them all throughout Park City. And on them was a turnkey app that was a morality app. Because one of the key things that I did with the project was I worked with Medic Mobile, who tracks births and disease within third world countries using mobile technology, and also with Freedom Lab that looks at wicked problems in terms of you know, trying to solve them and through collaboration and a variety of other design thinking processes. So on the actual phone was a morality app, and it would say, you know, your wife is sick, do you let her in, yes or no? And so as they went through, it would escalate, and it eventually would ask them a question. Now, what's interesting about this, and I think this was probably the most valuable part of the whole design of what we did, it was a touch point. The phones circulated probably about almost 5,000 times, and what was interesting is anytime somebody had it, I saw the handshake. I saw how long they were on the phone. I saw how deep they went into the data. I saw, you know, a variety of different data points that would come back and affect that main room. But also, people were able to remix stuff online. And when they remixed those assets online, they would unlock the phone numbers to these phones. So these phones were ringing constantly from all over the world, where people were freaking out, saying, oh, my God, you got to go find this golden thing that's hidden in Sundance. And, of course, somebody's like, I have no idea who you are. I have no idea what this phone's about. And so it created these really interesting connections between people. And so what would end up happening is when somebody would bring back the phone or bring back a golden object or bring back any of those things, the room would actually change state. So like if you set something down on that surface, the whole room would change. Next to it, I built a room that had all these photographs, like 50 different photographs of people with their eyes closed to simulate the sleep virus. And there's a book there that you can see in the upper left. For anybody that didn't have a smart device, they could come in and they could realize that the golden objects were actually related to each of the people, and you could start to track how the actual virus spread. And for the people who did have the phones, an NFC-compliant phone, when they would come into the room and put it up against the wall with all the people with their eyes closed, all of a sudden on their phone, their eyes would open. And so they would make a connection to that particular person, and they would be able to delve into the story. And so with that particular kind of telling of that story, I was also really driven by this idea of connected devices. Like, I think this is an amazing time to be a storyteller, because we're looking at this opportunity of the Internet of Things and the way that all these things are emerging that will be able to have story layer across them, game layer across them, educational value across them, discovery across them. And so we prototyped a number of bears, actually modeled off of my son, who's 4 years old, off of his bear. But basically, the bear had a camera in his stomach, a slide viewer in its eye, had an MP3 player in its paw, and had a way to dock it into a computer in its foot.
MacGyver.
So the bear kind of circulated all throughout the festival, and it was really a great... It mined some of the themes, because a lot of the stuff that I'm working on is really, and I think I've come to realize this, is like a lot of the times the themes will take me further than the actual characters within building these worlds. Pandemic, when I look at it, and if I'm honest with myself, very complex. You know, a lot of different things going on, a lot of moving parts and pieces. But a lot of those design things came back again in some really interesting ways. And what I want to kind of go into next is, it couldn't be any more opposite what I just described to you, but it takes a lot of the same design principles. And it's actually much harder to design something simply that's simple as opposed to something that's complex. So within this next project... It's part of a participatory storytelling trilogy that I'm doing, because I became really fascinated by what does it actually really mean to tell stories in the 21st century? What are audiences of tomorrow like? I honestly believe that those formerly known as the audience are actually collaborators, and so I wanted to collaborate, and so I decided to collaborate with a bunch of fifth graders. So what we did was we worked with fifth graders in Montreal, French-speaking, and at an at-risk school, and then fifth graders in Los Angeles at an at-risk school. And using math, science, history, geography, collaborative problem-solving, and creative writing, they moved our robot, who they named Laika, after the first dog in space. They moved her over 10 days in this beta test, over 2,000 miles, 52 different locations. And we had a team of photographers.
And that she had to get home.
She had to get home, right? Because basically, it's a hero's journey. She's here on this planet to see what the planet's all about. She's a scientist, fish out of water kind of story. Ends up stranded in Montreal and needs to make her way home. And so the kids start to help her. And so the kids effectively, like if the kids wanted her to go to Mount Rushmore and have tea with unicorns, we had photographers that would actually travel Laika to that location, photograph, and bring the kids' imaginations to life. And so what the kids actually started to do is they actually started to tell stories, and we started to collaborate with the kids, and they started to take over a part of the world. And the whole initiative was very much driven by digital literacy, driven by experiential learning, and driven by this desire to show how creativity can be sparked and the imagination of many can be ignited. And so we had, and this was something that I think was really valuable within the project, we had an aspect where I'm always looking within the design, because how can you have something that is universal or has a universal quality within it? So when you start to invite in participation, you're going to have it at a certain quality, because I'm always asked within these projects that I do that are large global projects, how do you manage or keep a consistency? Some of it is very simple. In these examples that you see here, there's a consistency with the heart, the antenna, the eyes. These were little heart packs that people could print out and do at home. So these are representative of ones that came in from all over the world, from parents and kids that would sit down and do it together, to schools that were doing it. And we had started in those two schools, and quickly we ended up in those 10 days in 8 different countries, multiple schools all over the world. And everybody came to realize that it wasn't energy, you know, it wasn't some fossil fuel or some alternative energy source that was driving Laika. It was actually passion and creativity. So what was exciting about that was, as the kids kind of expressed themselves, we had really great things like where a teacher who worked with autistic children contacted me and said that the kids had done like a coloring book version of what they were passionate about, and then they went to the library and they matched that to books. And it was the first time the kids all took out their own books, which was really cool. And in addition to that, it kind of created this really exciting way in which the kids who were in those at-risk schools wanted to travel, they wanted to see, they wanted to be able to go out and explore. And so I think when we go forward with this, the thing that's really kind of exciting for me about the project, and I think with a lot of the design, I try to almost be almost childlike in it, because not only is it a very ambitious project and Laika will travel the world and visit more schools, but at the end of this year, the artwork, Laika herself and all the stories will actually be shot into space. So when the kids look up into the night sky, they'll be reminded of how far their imaginations can carry them. So it's really kind of this this exploration into participatory culture that I think is really interesting. And because I'm incredibly ambitious, the next project in the trilogy, which actually we're prototyping later today at 12:30 here at South By, is builds off of a Buckminster Fuller quote and builds off of, if anybody's familiar with the golden records from Voyager, if anybody knows what they were, for people that don't, they crammed all this stuff, Carl Sagan, the guys crammed all this stuff onto these records, like 50 Greetings, Louis Armstrong, all this culture, jam-packed it onto these records and sent it out into space. So between the quote of like, how do we make the world work for 100%, which is very bold, we are doing this project called Wish for the Future. So you can go to wishforthefuture.com, and you can easily just make a wish for the future. Now, what happens is, in 140 characters or less, you make a wish. Those wishes are granted through a creative act. Could be a song, could be a video, could be a drawing, could be, you know, some creative expression. And then a number of those are then actually prototyped. And when I say that, they're actually brought into becoming artifacts. All those things are then sealed away in one of 7 time capsules that are buried for 100 years. So what we've been doing is we've been doing these really interesting prototypings. We did this last week with a bunch of kids, where kids come together and they work with adults, and we prototype different ideas based off of wishes, and that's what we're going to do today at 12:30.
Lance, where is that at 12:30? And then I'm going to have to rush you here.
Somewhere in this massive structure of this convention center.
Okay. And then I'm going to have to rush you so that we can...
Yeah.
So you almost done?
Yes, I'm 2 seconds away from completion.
Sorry.
Here's the energy-efficient jet that was made by one of the kids. This Kobe came up with a hoagie across America to help poverty, to help hunger, and a water slide across America to make cross-country travel more fun. I just had these tips that I thought were really kind of valuable that I wish somebody would have told me at some point when I was making stuff. So if I can just show
Are these also on your website maybe at Workbook Project?
No, but I'll leave them up while you while we move on.
Okay.
Because John doesn't have a presentation.
Okay.
That's my presentation there.
Does that work?
Yeah, no. There are five there, and then what are the next five?
I can't tell you. No, okay. I'm kidding.
Part of the story. So, Lance, oh my gosh, you know, I there's never enough time. I just want to say that coming to John, who actually has just so much interaction with his audience, you're really starting to notice a trend here, and it's not something I planned on, actually. I really didn't. But a couple things note that I've observed here. One is good stories make us care. And I truly believe that storytelling will save the world. And we are our stories. It's how we connect. It's how we create. It's how we learn. And now, it's how we solve problems. Mm-hmm. So all of this, you know, I think now storytellers, not to pressure us, but I think we have a really wonderful responsibility in how we empower ourselves and the audience. So, John, you have an ongoing conversation with your audience. You and I have talked about this for a year, and now with G.I. Joe 2, when we were talking about the panel, you were talking about Dwayne Johnson's fans, The Rock, your fans, and this process that's been happening throughout the production of G.I. Joe 2, and I thought it was so incredible. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. You know, what I loved about what Lance said was he said, this is a great time to be a storyteller, and I believe that fully. I feel like I have tools at my fingertips to use, especially when I see everybody's presentations here, to tell story in such different ways and to emotionally.
By the way, John's presentation is G.I. Joe 2, because that's what he's been doing.
Thank you. To me, we live in such an amazing time, and you know, it's crazy because just watching this stuff that you guys have done, it like opens my brain so much. Being in the feature film studio world, it's still not like so open to see stuff like this, and so it really sparks stuff in my brain. I'm used to sort of traditional stuff of in a story. You there's a beginning, a middle, and an end, and you bring people into your room and you present it and you guide them through your adventure, and then you guide them out, and that's that. And I don't have a big whole sort of theory on how that's changing right now, other than sort of my own experience and what I've found in the last several years of making movies on sort of the studio level, because I do find myself having to focus on other things as well as just the story itself, beginning, middle, and end. It's not just about people going to the movie theater, paying for their ticket, coming and watching the movie, and leaving and have it in the memory. There is a. I find myself increasingly having to talk to the audience more and more. And I think that's a. When I think about it, it's actually sort of like when you're telling a story around a campfire in a way. Yes, you tell your story, but what really makes it scary, what really draws you in is the fire itself. How close are you to the fire? Or the lighting in the place? Are there trees next to you? What's your company? Is someone sitting right close to you where you can feel their breath a little bit? All those things affect how you experience the story. And in the same way now, sort of digitally, I find that you have to, there's sort of this community that already exists before the movie even comes out, and you have to deal with that. You actually as a storyteller, you have to prep your story how you want to prepare it. You actually have to create the path that your audience will come to your story with, which in the future I think will involve more and more of this kind of stuff, which is really exciting. And I just have a couple examples. I don't have a theory on it all. It's just sort of my own experience. But for Justin Bieber, for instance, for those of you who don't know, I did the Justin Bieber movie, and that was an amazing experience. I did not know his fans. His fans are extremely protective of him. They don't like outsiders coming in, especially a 32-year-old Asian man to come tell the story of Justin Bieber. But what we did was we knew we had to take control of the story early. So as soon as I got the job, literally within days, I flew out to Atlanta to go meet with Justin, and Scooter, his manager, was really smart and all this stuff. Immediately, he said, "He has to anoint you," which is a little strange, but I was like, all right, let's do it. So we go into his, I never met him before. We go into his bus and we shoot a little video on my iPhone. He's like, John, you have to post it. We'll retweet it so that it comes from Justin, but it's on your thing. And we're going to basically announce you. So go into his bus and he says, basically, there's this guy that's been following me around. I don't know why. And he's like, but I just found out that he's making my movie. And we made this stupid little video. And it went crazy among his fans. And he said a couple very nice things about me, even though he didn't know who I was. And it was great because the fans then embraced me, and then with the story had to continue. So we had to literally every couple days make another video of what we were doing and include his audience in
so
the adventure.
So while you were making his story, you were telling yours and his story together.
Yes, yeah. When I started the story, I had 12,000 followers that night. By the time the movie came out, I believe I had about 350,000 followers. That day, I was going up like 1,000 every 2 minutes.
John, did those followers affect the way you edited the film in the end?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is where it sort of changed my brain, because suddenly every moment we were in New York City and he was performing at Madison Square Garden that night. I got a helicopter to go around and get some like establishing shots of the place. As I'm going up, I'm like, this is a great opportunity. I tweet out to everybody, hey, if you're walking to Madison Square Garden, make sure you're wearing your purple Justin Bieber colors and tweet me your cross streets and we'll do a flyby. So literally we're in the air getting tweets about where the Justin Bieber fans are, and we're doing flybys on these corner, and it was such, like, they loved it. They ate it up. It was like power that these kids had.
And who knew that same technology would find Osama bin Laden.
Exactly. Yeah. And in the same way, that's what happened in the edit room. I would have two clips, and I'd say, hey, do you want me to put this clip where he slips or this clip where he does his hair flip? And they would all sort of do, even though sometimes I had my mind sort of set on something, and it would change it, and other times they would support an idea that I knew, I thought they would like, but didn't quite know.
So this is, you're getting into, like, hairy territory. So, like, Tim Kring, he might do it with touch, but he didn't do it with heroes because he said he was getting Twitter assassination threats. Yeah. I mean, you're dealing with the audience is very, very passionate. Is this like a slippery slope? Is this
definitely? I mean, you definitely find yourself caught in certain ways, and every filmmaker has their own view of how they are telling their story. If they need to tell it in tunnel vision, which is totally fine and awesome when they get to do that, and other filmmakers get to tell it in different ways. For me, I love finding out, especially when I wasn't versed on Justin Bieber, to at least know where the fans stood, because then we could go against it, we could play against it, what they thought, or we could play with it. But more importantly, it set the tone that we were making this together. His journey was made with his fans, and we were going to make this movie with his fans, and they're going to be the ones who fill it. When we opened the weekend, we said, everybody fill your theater. And everyone filled their theater. We made this little JPEG of a glow stick, and said during all the songs, download this for free, put it on your iPhone, and wave it in the air for the last song. And we went to the theater, and people did that. So
the most effective brands today are the ones whose audience perceives that they own them or actually have some sort of say. So you actually allowed Bieber's fans to think this was their movie, that they actually made this movie, and you were just their.
Yeah, and in fact, when we came down to it, there were so many things that they wanted to put in that I knew couldn't fit in the movie that we wanted to show general audience. So we 2 weeks after it came out, we talked to Paramount and said, listen, we're 90% digital theaters. We have 40 minutes of extra footage. Let's cut out 15 minutes and put in 40 minutes and make it the director's fan cut to show and maybe the fans will come back 2 weeks later. There was a big sort of issue with that with all the distributors. We worked it out. So literally 2 weeks after the movie came out, which is unheard of, we released a totally new movie, basically 40 minutes of different footage in that, and they came back, and it was sort of a groundbreaking.
So then you already had some experience, and you went into G.I. Joe.
Yes.
The Rock has
a
fanatic fan base.
Yes. This is, again, what's interesting is now I have, 420,000 followers that are Justin Bieber followers, right. Not G.I. Joe people. G.I. Joe people are got news that, oh my gosh, the Justin Bieber guy and the Step Up guy is going to do G.I. Joe with The Rock? What the? So now I had to figure out a way to convert Justin Bieber fans to G.I. Joe fans and G.I. Joe fans to to not think that I was going to do the Justin Bieber movie again. So I had to take control of the environment that I was in, and we had to redefine the story. So step by step, again, getting The Rock to tweet things about me. It was sort of funny because he would do really funny things, like sort of bag on me a bit, so that we could sort of show them how the relationship would grow. You know, at the shooting range when we would train with the shooting thing. Then, you know, he's gigantic and I'm like next to him with this little gun, and that sort of personality, that sort of friendship grew, and the audience grew with it. I also had to communicate my love for G.I. Joe and what I thought this movie was going to be different from the last movie, and how I'm a baby of the 80s, so I knew the franchise very well and what I wanted Joe to be in the ultimate Joe movie. So we got to really participate with the toy line of how we were designing the toys and show the fans early. We got to show when we were blowing things up. That was the main thing, is to show that we were going to be tough in this movie. It wasn't going to be all green screen. It wasn't going to be just laser guns and include them in this process. So obviously we're in the process now of telling that story, but again, you have cast members such as Bruce Willis, The Rock, RZA, Wu-Tang, and Ray Park, all who have fanboys themselves, and so we all have to we come together and sort of figure out our story together. It's not necessarily all planned out, but just personality-wise, it's fun to create that environment.
So if you didn't embrace this, you'd be in trouble, actually.
I mean, I think that's the thing, is like right now, every storyteller has to embrace it because that's the environment that people are going into your movie. Now, how much you do or what you do with it, that's up to the artist, whatever they want. But for me, it's been really fascinating in my own experience that it's becoming more and more a priority of how you frame your movie before they go in. Because guess what? While your movie's going, they're searching on Google for something they see in your movie. When they come out, they're looking for something from your movie. And if you haven't put it in, if you haven't planned out, then you're just one step behind your audience, which is well, you never want to be. You want to be ahead.
You know, it's interesting. Something that I'm working on, right, a project that we're working on, we're actually, and there are companies that do this, like Trender. We're following sentiment index, and the sentiment index.
I have no idea what that means.
The sentiment index are the conversations that are happening amongst the audience around a specific property.
Yes.
So we're not in direct communication with the audience. We're just kind of watching what they're talking about and where the spikes are to kind of address. It's kind of like a build-in focus group that you're really, you know, you're just watching. I get the feeling you had a comment for John.
I
have time for one question. I'm so sorry. So microphone's right there. Jump so we can hear you. You guys rock, by the way.
Thank you for the really interesting discussion and the different points of view. I have a question. I'm going to ask you to speculate on.
What's your name first?
Bruce Henderson.
Great.
And I work in advertising. I help people make better purchase decisions. Given the complexity, evolutionary nature, non-linear aspect of multi-platform storytelling, is it possible to imagine that any of these types of stories that originate in this form will endure in the future? I mean, when you think of something like The Odyssey that was written in 8 BC and then sort of revisited in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, the simplicity of the story and the classic hero art, is able to be told and retold and retold. Is it possible to imagine that stories will be that have this amount of complexity will actually be retold 1,000 years from now?
So I'm gonna jump right to John. The greatest multi-platform story ever told that you told me is?
Well, I think it was what I told you was Christmas. To me, it was like they have all these songs that people are creating for it, the story of the different elves or Santa Claus, people are reinterpreting what the story of Santa Claus is, or what it means. That's like the ultimate, and any genre in any way you can tell the story of Christmas, which is kind of interesting.
And so I think, you know, if you just want to run down quickly and give your answer about the endurance of multi-platform stories, so my opinion is it's all about the story world you create, not necessarily where it lives.
Right, and I mean, I would say I love that example of Christmas, because really stories about understanding, you know, ourselves and our place in communities and in the world, right? And so, how we understand our place in a community is changing now because of these different ways of communicating with each other. But the need to understand our place in community doesn't change. And I think that what you're going to see is these stories kind of maybe, yes, they break up and they're told over these different platforms, but they are the same stories. They're the same things we need to understand about ourselves and the world.
Yeah,
And I'll just say that, you know, there are really only seven stories out there, right? It's just how you tell them. So I think it's definitely, like you're saying, it's going to continue, and we'll be telling the same stories and just different ways of doing it.
I think the answer is yes.
So I just, I'm going to tell you something that's my own, like, personal militant platform here. Story first. Because if you don't have the story, you have nothing. Don't be seduced by the technology. It enables you to tell your story in a million ways. Story first. Yeah. So, Tracy, Dina, Lance, John, how great to have you today. Thank you so much. I've been inspired by everything I've seen today. I hope you have been too.
Thank you.